So, what did Batman say to Robin right before they got into the Batmobile? Robin, get into the Batmobile. Rita Turcava just told me that one. So, also, she told me this interesting riddle. So, what has six eyes and two noses and three mouths? What the riddle is, what has six eyes, two noses, and three mouths? A monster. See, even though those may not strictly speaking be Russian jokes, they came from an honest to God Russian, and they have the flavor, you have to admit. Or she, no, I don't think she's actually Russian, but she speaks Russian. She's from somewhere that used to be a part of the Soviet Union. Anyway. Okay, so maybe I'll get going. So the one takeaway message from this morning's lecture, which you should carry with you into the future, is that if you think about these three puzzles that were kind of bothering people in the late 70s, so the flatness puzzle, the flatness puzzle again is, why is it that when we measure the energy density today, it appears to be tuned to be equal to the critical density to within 1%? And then if the universe was decelerating for the past 14 billion years, if we follow the clock backwards in time, at earlier times it was even more finely tuned to be equal to the critical density. So at Big Bang nucleosynthesis, it would have been tuned to the critical density to better than a part in 10 to the 31. So that's one puzzle, what's going on there. The second puzzle is, in a decelerating universe, the second puzzle is the horizon puzzle. In a decelerating universe, every observer is surrounded, at a given time, is surrounded by a causal horizon from beyond which they can't have received signals. And if you, an observer further in the past, is surrounded by a smaller and smaller causal horizon. So if we look back at two different blobs of fluid on opposite sides of the sky that 14 billion years ago released CMB photons to us, each of those was surrounded by a very tiny causal horizon that made it impossible for them to communicate with one another before sending those photons to us. So how did they know to send us photons at the same temperature? And then three, the monopole puzzle. If the standard model is really embedded in a grand unified theory, then very generically, that embedding supports topological field configurations that are called topological defects, and in particular, in this case, monopoles, field configurations that are stable because unwrapping them requires changing the actual topology of the field configuration. So if the universe was really radiation dominated all the way back up to arbitrarily high temperatures, and the universe really is embedded in a grand unified theory this way, then as the universe cooled at some high temperature, at the gut temperature, these topological defects would have formed when the grand unified theory spontaneously, its symmetry spontaneously broke down to the low energy standard model gauge group. And so you can roughly estimate that at the time that symmetry breaking would happen, you would get one monopole per co-moving horizon volume at that time. But since the co-moving horizon volume in the decelerating epoch has been growing, the number of co-moving horizon volumes at that time that fit into the co-moving horizon volume today is huge. You predict that there will be a huge number of monopoles inside our horizon, each of which is quite massive. The overall prediction is that the density in monopoles today is much, much greater, many orders of magnitude greater than the critical density today. Okay, so there's a problem. And so people found it suddenly in 1980, it was realized that these three problems could be apparently have a common resolution if the following simple geometric picture held, that instead of the universe being decelerating all the way back, so that last time we introduced this notion of the co-moving co-moving Hubble radius, which is the normal Hubble radius, 1 over h, converted into a co-moving length by dividing also by a. So 1 over ah is the co-moving Hubble radius. We said that since that's nothing but a dot, in a decelerating universe, that radius expands with time. And so if the universe had been decelerating all the way back, the co-moving Hubble radius has been monotonically increasing throughout the age of the universe. But all of these puzzles could be solved by imagining that instead of that being the case, there was an earlier accelerated epoch, which made this change non-monotonically with time. So there was an initial epoch where this co-moving Hubble radius decreased, and then that gave over to the Big Bang era that we know and love, where it's been increasing. And in particular, the key requirement that is needed to simultaneously satisfy all three puzzles is that the amount of contraction that took place, the factor by which the co-moving Hubble radius contracted between the beginning of inflation and the end of inflation, that is to say, the moment of quote-unquote reheating, is greater than the factor by which it is re-expanded between then and today. Or in other words, it's the requirement is simply that the co-moving Hubble radius today fits well inside the co-moving Hubble radius at the beginning of inflation. So there are these two co-moving Hubble spheres around us, the one today and the one at the beginning of inflation. And the picture is the one at the beginning of inflation. Who knows how large it is, but it has to be at least significantly larger than the one today. Okay, so that was the takeaway point from last time. Now you might say, well, that's fine, but you know, just kind of invoking an earlier epoch where the scale factor accelerated instead of decelerating, you know, sounds kind of gross. Didn't you tell me in a previous lecture that normal radiation components like non-relativistic dust or relativistic radiation give rise to a decelerating expansion? It's not fair to just invoke crazy matter out of the blue, and that's true. Nevertheless, so we will invoke matter, but in some sense, well, take it for what it will. Take it for what it's worth. The point is that the following component does the job. If you just take a single scalar field, with exactly the same Lagrangian that we had previously invoked as the simplest example of a non-thermal relic. So we add a single scalar field, and let's imagine that it dominated the universe at early times. At early times, it was the dominant energy component. So that means that the action is something like, it's the action for gravity. So we have d4x square root of minus g, and then the action is the gravitational part of the action, the Einstein-Hilbert term, and then the action for an ordinary scalar field. Where V of phi is, this again, the simplest potential you can think of, just that of a free massive scalar field. Okay. And that's supposed to hit zero there. You know what I mean? This is V of phi versus phi. Okay, then what happens is that let me actually back up a step. So in general, the simplest models of inflation, the simplest models for what the matter is that the simplest model for what the matter is that drove inflation is a Lagrangian like this. And if V satisfies a certain criteria, which I will now tell you, then those models give rise to successful inflation. So that's called single field inflation. You can come up with more complicated examples of what did inflation, but this is the minimal and also by far the most predictive and the most, at this point, successful, that is to say, it has made the most successful predictions version of inflation. So to say what the criteria are, let's start by defining two parameters in terms of the potential, the so-called slow roll parameters, epsilon and eta. So epsilon is defined as 1/2 Planck mass squared times the first derivative of phi, the first derivative of v with respect to phi over v squared. And eta is defined as the Planck mass squared times the second derivative of v with respect to phi over v. Okay, so in other words, epsilon and eta both depend on phi. They're two parameters that are defined at any point. You can calculate them at any point along this potential by calculating the first and second derivatives of the potential and taking these ratios. Capital M Planck squared. Okay. A bit confusingly, but it's something to get used to, or else you'll go crazy trying to read papers and so forth, are that there are two different things that are both called the Planck mass. So one of them is, which is sort of these days commonly written as lowercase m Planck, is equal to 1 over the square root of g Newton in units where h bar is equal to c is equal to 1. And this guy is about 10 to the 19 GeV. And then capital M Planck is, unfortunately, differs from that by a factor of square root of 8 pi. So it's 1 over the square root of 8 pi G Newton. And this guy is about 2.5 times 10 to the 18 GeV. Anyway, it's not a big deal. It's just so you won't get confused by the formula. But it turns out that it's very convenient algebraically to soak up factors of pi into the definition of M Planck. You end up reducing the number of pi's that float around in your subsequent expressions. Okay, and so for example, in these terms, the Friedmann equation is 8 pi g over 3, so that's just 1 over 3 M Planck squared times the energy density minus k over a squared. Okay, so a potential is satisfies slow roll inflation if it basically the idea is it has some minimum that is more or less at v is equal to 0, and as you displace the field in one direction or another from that minimum, if you displace it far enough away, you reach a region where these two dimensionless parameters, epsilon and eta, are much less than unity. So that region up here where epsilon and eta are much less than unity is called the so-called slow roll portion of the potential. And we'll see that, this is the region where the field is going to be behaving like it's overdamped, like it's like the friction, the Hubble friction will be more important than the potential in this region. And then finally, you'll get out of this region. This will be, as the field oozes down here, inflation will be taking place up here. It'll cross a region where suddenly, it'll cross into a region of the potential where near the bottom, epsilon and eta are no longer much greater than, are no longer much less than 1. They become comparable to or bigger than 1. And at that point, inflation ends. The universe stops accelerating, and reheats. And so that all sounds like, that's what you want. You want the field. You want to somehow be able to displace the field into a region where the potential is flat enough that initially these two conditions are satisfied, and then as it oozes down, there's a transition point where beyond which those conditions are no longer satisfied, the field becomes underdamped and begins to oscillate. And that all sounds like a lot of requirements and a lot of strange requirements, but again, the point is that this potential does the job perfectly well, so let's just see how that goes. So if we take V prime here, we get M Planck squared phi. So if you take M Planck squared phi over 1/2 M Planck squared phi squared, we'll get 1 half m Planck squared, and then 1 over phi squared. And then I may also be losing a factor of, I guess we get maybe 4 over phi squared. Anyway, it doesn't. These numerical factors don't matter. The point is, this is basically m Planck over phi all squared. So as long as once phi gets bigger than m Planck, once phi is much bigger than m Planck, or let's say by the time phi is a factor of a few or 10 bigger than m Planck, epsilon is indeed much less than 1. And similarly here, if we take the second derivative, we get the second derivative of this is just m squared. So plugging in here, we get okay, and again, I may have just screwed up the numerical factors, but the key point is that both of them just go as the ratio of m Planck over phi squared. And so they both, as soon as phi has gotten displaced by, as soon as phi has been pulled more than m Planck in this direction, been displaced from the origin by more than m Planck in field space, these things are satisfied. So the slow roll conditions are satisfied. But then once it gets closer to the origin than m Planck, they're no longer satisfied. So why is that good? Well, for one thing, it will automatically give rise to what we want. We'll see that model automatically, when it's in the slow roll, when the field is sufficiently displaced sufficiently far, and it's sort of in that slow roll regime, it's overdamped, and during that phase, the universe automatically accelerates. And then once it crosses down into this underdamped regime and begins to oscillate, the universe is converted to decelerated expansion. Okay. So let's just see that. Basically, qualitatively, without getting without attempting to be too formal about it, let me just make the argument as follows. Just to give an intuitive picture, not to give a rigorous derivation. H, by the Friedman equation, is proportional to. So the Friedman equation says H is proportional to. Okay, forgetting about the curvature term for a minute. So forget that guy. H squared is proportional to rho. So, and then rho is at least as big as V, because rho, the energy density of the scalar field, remember, is its kinetic energy, 1 half phi dot squared, plus its potential energy. So rho is at least as big as V. So when V gets big, H gets big. Meanwhile, in this slow roll regime, one of these slow roll conditions is precisely that V prime is very small relative to V. So it's precisely the region where the forcing term is small and the friction term is big. Okay, so it's in this regime where we kind of expect the behavior to be overdamped. If I go up to the top of the what is the name of the tall tower in Toronto, the CN Tower? If I go up to the top of the CN Tower and I drop I was thinking of something funny to drop, but then you shouldn't. Good not. Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that, but then that could sound weird. Anyway, so but now that I haven't said it, it doesn't sound weird at all. The object, reaches terminal velocity, right? It quickly reaches terminal velocity, which is just the situation in which basically its further acceleration becomes negligible because it has managed to speed up until it balances the frictional force against the force that's drawing it downward, gravitational force, the driving force. And so that's the same in this friction-dominated regime. That's the same thing that will happen. Qualitatively, the field will speed up until the friction balances the potential wanting to slide it downhill, and the acceleration will be negligible. It'll basically be at its terminal velocity. So in other words, neglect this. This equation is approximately true by itself. So the up in this regime, the field rolls down with its terminal velocity, which is approximately given by minus v prime of phi over 3h. Okay, that's one of the so-called slow roll equations. But if that's satisfied, then we can show that the condition that epsilon is much less than 1 precisely then implies that phi dot squared is much less than v. In other words, the kinetic energy of the field is much less than its potential energy in that regime. So we'll show that in 1 second. And the reason, but the point of showing that is that I remind you that the energy density and pressure are given by these two expressions. So if phi dot squared is negligible relative to v, in that regime, this is just basically plus v and this is minus v. So p is approximately equal to minus rho, or in other words, w is approximately equal to minus 1, as it is for a cosmological constant. And as we've already discussed in previous lectures, but we'll see again in 1 second, when the dominant energy component satisfies W is approximately equal to minus 1, that leads to accelerated expansion. Okay, so let's first check this thing that I said. So epsilon is equal to, defined to be 1/2 m Planck squared v prime over v squared. By the slow roll equation, v prime is equal to minus 3h phi dot. So if we use that expression, we have now we have this 9h squared m Planck squared. Let's forget this guy. 3h squared m Planck squared is equal to rho, according to the Friedman equation, unless the deviations from flatness are huge. I'll take 3 from this 9, h squared m Planck squared, and convert that into rho. But rho is at least as big as v. I mean, rho is greater than or equal to v by this expression. So this thing is greater than that, where I now only have one factor of v on the bottom. And then on the other hand, the slow roll condition is that epsilon is much less than 1. So all in all, we have shown that the kinetic energy is much less than the potential energy when the slow roll condition is satisfied. And so then it's clear that from these equations implies that W is approximately equal to minus 1. And now, as the final step, I just want to remind you why it is, or show you why it is that W is roughly equal to minus 1 implies that the universe is accelerating. So there we should just take our, so in most cases, the two homogeneous equations of motion to use are the two that we have been using, the Friedman equation and the continuity equation. But in this case, it's useful to take these two and combine them to get another equation that refers to the acceleration specifically. So the way to do that is, suppose you took the time derivative of both sides of this equation. So you would get 2h h dot on this side. Here you would get 8 pi g over 3 rho dot, and then plus 2 a dot over a cubed times k. Anyway, divide use this expression for rho dot to remove rho dot here. Then you'll have a factor of h in every expression. Divide that out. You'll have another factor of h squared in the remaining equation, which you can use this undifferentiated expression to remove. Anyway, so you basically by just differentiating this expression and then using these two expressions to simplify the differentiated result, you get another equation, which is often useful, which is minus 4 pi g over 3 rho plus 3 p. Or in other words, we can write minus 4 pi g over 3 as minus 1 over 6 m Planck squared. And then we can write rho plus 3 p as 1 plus 3 w rho. Just pulling a factor of rho out of this expression. And so this, basically, the point here is that if this factor, 1 plus 3w, is negative, then that minus sign combined with this minus sign makes this whole expression positive. So in other words, the acceleration is positive. So to get acceleration, we want the dominant matter component, the dominant energy component, to have w less than minus 1/3 to make this whole thing negative. And so w is approximately equal to minus 1, you know, does that. Okay? And then on the other hand, I won't derive this, but we had derived in a previous lecture that we've already discussed what happens in the underdamped regime. Once you get down to the region near the, once the field oozes sufficiently near the minimum, it oscillates. Its behavior is proportional to, well, it oscillates with a frequency set by its mass, cosine mt, and then it decays, with its amplitude decays as a to the minus 3/2 of t. And we said in the limit, in this regime, approximately its energy density then scales as a to the minus 3, just like dust does. So in other words, this is dust. It's like, remember, for a general W, we have this, we in an earlier lecture derived this expression that for a general W, energy density scales. If we plug in a constant W here and integrate this expression, we got that the continuity equation said that rho scaled is a to the minus 3, 1 plus W. So if this guy is scaling as a to the minus 3, that means it has effectively a W that is equal to 0. So this thing is no longer negative. It's become positive. So the universe automatically accelerates when the field is sufficiently far out, and then starts decelerating when the field has reached the bottom. Okay? So then we still haven't explained. You still have to give this field now. The next idea is, okay, in the simplest model, this field is completely decoupled from the rest of the standard model. You just take the standard model action and add on this action for a scalar field. And if that was all that happened, that would not be a successful model. At the end of the day, you do have to introduce terms here that couple phi to the fields in the standard model so that this won't just sit here oscillating forever, that it will eventually dump its energy into the standard model, the particles of the standard model, and quote-unquote reheat the universe. But anyway, the standard model plus this action supplemented by some, it's not terribly specific what you need to put in, but some appropriately large coupling terms between the field and standard model matter are the basic inputs for the simplest model of inflation. And so now, in the final half, I just want to sort of introduce you to the quantitative calculation of how this model. The idea is, okay, you've put in this scalar field, and because its homogeneous evolution seems to do exactly what you want. First, it makes the universe accelerate, and then it makes the universe decelerate. But then quantum mechanics forbids you. You can't just put in a perfectly homogeneous scalar field. It has to have some even in the vacuum state, it has to have some minimum fluctuations around pure homogeneity. And in fact, if you put in the smallest possible fluctuations at the beginning and then just follow what the expansion of the universe does to those fluctuations, it amplifies them and stretches their wavelength so that they end up with a spectrum, a statistical spectrum that very, very well matches the spectrum of perturbations that we need to have in the early universe to explain the cosmic microwave background observations and structure formation. Okay? So I'm just going to sketch. So that somehow is, yeah. Well, the 0 point fluctuations of the vacuum fluctuations of the field. Well, we'll see what specifically I mean by that in 1 second, in the last half of the lecture. So let me also say I'm still fiddling with the problem set, but I'll send that out either this afternoon or tomorrow. But the basic idea is to sketch this calculation now and then in enough detail, and then also have the notes have enough detail that you'll be able to go through without too much difficulty the calculation on your own, and you know. Have it make more sense than it will in this rather fast pass, and then the more important thing to say is that, you know, obviously there's only so much depth in which this calculation can be done, in only half an hour. It's if you're interested in learning more about this, this is definitely the part of the material that will be covered in the explorations course. But I just want to make sure that even for people who don't take that. The cosmology explorations course, that, you know, it's good to at least have met the basic calculation in passing once in your life.
Can you remind me how the school that we had in the oscillating period that we had deceleration?
So the argument was, so first, the intuitive argument why rho scales as a to the minus 3 here is that the energy density is 1/2 phi dot squared plus v, which in this case is 1/2 m squared phi squared. And so if we neglected the expansion of the universe, the underdamped region where we're oscillating is the region where the expansion, the friction due to the expansion of the universe is, okay, it's not gone, but it's small relative to the forcing due to the mass. So if we neglected it completely, then the energy density of a harmonic oscillator would just be 1/2 m squared phi squared, where phi was whatever the amplitude of the oscillation was. In other words, that's the value of the energy density here, you know, evaluated at the end point, at the turning points of the oscillation. The largest amplitude points, where phi dot is equal to 0 and the field has come to rest and it's turning around. But then in the absence of the expansion of the universe, that's a constant. That would be the value throughout the oscillation. But then due to the expansion of the universe, the effect of the friction term is to slowly shrink the amplitude proportional to a to the minus 3/2. And since the amplitude appears squared in the potential, the energy density, so in other words, since the energy density is proportional to the amplitude squared and the amplitude is shrinking as a to the minus 3/2, the energy density shrinks as a to the minus 3. But then we said, on the other hand, an energy component with a constant W has energy density that scales as a to the minus 3, 1 plus W. So comparing those two things, we say, aha, this thing is behaving, comparing these two expressions, we say, this underdamped scalar field is behaving as if it had W is equal to 0. On the other hand, this equation says that when W is greater than minus 1/3, so that this factor is positive, then because of this minus sign, A double dot is negative. So as soon as, yeah.
So mm-hmm. just to clarify, so in the damped phase, W is smaller than minus one third, and then when it hits the underdamped phase, it goes into W is equal to zero.
Exactly. That's right. So accelerating corresponds to W less than minus a third. This decelerating phase corresponds to W greater than minus a third. In particular, for this potential, what we argued was that in fact it has W is approximately equal to minus one, which satisfies this condition initially, and then it has W approximately equal to zero, which satisfies this condition eventually. Okay. Okay. So there's an initial step in the perturbation calculation which is a bit of a mess. And I give you a reference, a 2003 paper by Maldacena where he shows how to do it relatively neatly. But I'm not going to do that here. I'm just going to summarize the idea, okay? So the metric looks like it has 10 components. It's a symmetric 4x4 matrix. But there are four constraint equations. Basically, the fact that the Bianchi identities demand that the divergence of the Einstein tensor vanishes. Those give you four constraint equations. And then, on the other hand, you also have arbitrary coordinate freedom. Different metrics that look different and look like they have different components actually can correspond to the same physical metric, just expressed in different coordinates. So we have four functional degrees of freedom. We have four coordinates that we can transform arbitrarily from x coordinates to x twiddle coordinates. So this is four equations that eats four of the components. This is four equations that also eats four of the components. So at the end of the day, we have 10 minus 4 is equal to 2 remaining dynamical, genuine degrees of freedom in the metric. And these are the two polarizations of the graviton, of a gravitational wave. Okay, now we're going to add, we're going to work in this approximation where in the early universe there was only one other important field, and it was just a single real scalar field. So in addition to these 2 degrees of freedom, we now have 3 degrees of freedom. We have one more. So we have 3 degrees of freedom. And we're going to consider now perturbations in those 3 degrees of freedom and how they evolve. So an important idea in cosmology, and here again, there's a if you want to understand more about this, there is a classic 1980 reference by this guy, James Bardeen, about this called gauge invariant cosmological perturbation theory. So the idea is, you know, when the universe was perfectly homogeneous, there was this well-defined way to slice the universe up into spatial slices. We took the spatial slices to be the maximally symmetric spatial surfaces in the spacetime. But now when we perturb those surfaces, if we no longer require that the metric and matter fields are perfectly homogeneous on those surfaces but have little perturbations, that breaks all that symmetry, and now it suddenly becomes ambiguous how to slice up the space-time. So for example, you could imagine that there's a space-time, there's a way to slice the surfaces so that, for example, the curvature is constant everywhere on this spatial surface, but the field, the value of the field maybe wiggles. But okay, maybe I could alternatively, oh, maybe I should say, okay, let me take this as my spatial surface. So I'll take a surface along which the field value is constant everywhere. But then I pay the price that on that slightly different spatial slice, the curvature looks wiggly. So this is kind of a subtle issue if you've never met it before. But the point is that due to coordinate freedom, there's once you perturb a Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe, you know, it's not, you can, by changing coordinates slightly, you can make it look like different quantities are the things carrying that perturbation. Okay? So, to deal with this conveniently, it's good to pick a good gauge. It's good to pick a, you know, we'll use our freedom to take different coordinates and move the perturbation into different variables to choose a coordinate system that is nicely chosen so that the perturbation variable that ultimately we want to follow obeys the simplest equations. Okay, so what we do is we first take the metric and write it in so-called ADM form. Okay, so this is just, remember the metric has 10 components, here we've just written those 10 components and we've just kind of split them up in a certain way. So this n is one can depend arbitrarily on space and time, so it's one of the components. This three vector of fields ni is another three of the components, and then the 3x3 spatial metric here, gamma ij, has the remaining six. So we've split the 10 components of g mu nu into the one component of n, the three components of n sub I, and the six components of gamma ij, where gamma ij is now, the idea is this is a convenient splitting for a number of reasons, but for us, the particular point is that when you split things up in this way, you can think of these as the degrees of freedom as all being contained here, and then the four constraint equations determine these guys. Okay, so this has six components. We'll use our gauge freedom to kill four of the six components and leave two components here. Or three in the presence of a scalar field. And then from then on, we can just ignore these guys. The n and n sub I just come along for the ride. Whatever we specify here will then determine the values of these things via the constraint equations. So I just have to tell you what gauge conditions I'm going to specify to take this and the perturbation of the scalar field from apparently one plus six components down to three components, which is really what we said. There's really only going to be three components at the end of the day. So the gauge condition I'll take is I'll work in a gauge in which the field doesn't fluctuate. So I'll define my coordinates to coincide with the surfaces of constant field value. So along those spatial surfaces, the field has no spatial dependence. The perturbation in the field, the spatially dependent. If I write the field as a homogeneous part that only depends on time, and a little perturbation that depends on space and time, I'm going to choose coordinates in which that vanishes. Okay, that's one of my gauge conditions. And then for the rest of my gauge conditions, I will write gamma ij in the form where, okay, I'll split it into, this is a 3x3 matrix, I'll split it into a 3x3 matrix with unit determinant and a 3x3, and times a factor that basically carries the determinant. So I'll write this as e to the 2 zeta. That's the factor that carries the determinant, depends on space and time. And then a factor that does not carry the determinant. the factor with unit determinants. So e to the 2 hij depends on space and time. So in order for this to have no determinant, this part to have no determinant, hij has to be traceless. That's equivalent to saying that the thing that appears in the exponent here, the matrix that appears in the exponent, is traceless. In other words, hij delta ij is equal to 0. And then also the final gauge condition is that this guy is transverse. So I have three more gauge conditions to specify, and I take them to be like this. So that all undoubtedly went by rather fast. But the point is, I'm just trying to get us to the point where I can say, okay, we've specified a model, we've fixed coordinates enough for me to actually say what I'm even calculating with. And let me just say that now, at the end of the day, this thing has the physical interpretation that it gives rise to the primordial density perturbation. So you'll hear this thing zeta is referred to as the quote unquote primordial scalar perturbation, or the primordial curvature perturbation, or colloquially you might hear it referred to as the primordial density perturbation, because it is indeed the perturbation that later will be naturally interpreted in a different gauge as the perturbation and as the thing that gives rise to the primordial perturbations in the density field that grow under gravitational instability, like we described before. Okay, so this is the thing that's really most important to understand and calculate. This is the one that we've already detected. This guy is also there. This you'll hear it described as the primordial primordial tensor perturbation, or the primordial gravitational wave field. So these are. This is the perturbation that would still be present even if the scalar field wasn't around, even if we only had our 2 degrees of freedom that we have in vacuum. This is the perturbation that carries those. These have not been detected yet, the primordial gravitational waves predicted by inflation, but people are hard at work trying to detect them, and hopefully they will be detected, possibly even this decade, but it's not clear yet.
The two gauge choices you wrote for H, the first one is that HIJ is traceless.
Yeah.
And the second one?
Whoops. That's supposed to say delta JK.
Oh.
In other words, the divergence of HIJ is equal to 0. Okay. So, now that we've specified all of this, I am going to quote the messy result. So there's messy algebra. Maldesana teaches you how to do the algebra in a not messy way. But at the end of the day, you get the following clean result. So the statement is, suppose you take the action. You take the action for gravity. You take this action for the Einstein-Hilbert term plus the single scalar field. You impose these gauge conditions, and now you just plug in. This and this, and expand that thing in powers of zeta and h, treating them as small quantities. So you do a Taylor series expansion in powers of these two guys. Then the first non-vanishing term that you get you take that full action. And, in other words, the full action depends on the metric and the scalar field. You write the metric as a homogeneous part, that, in other words, the Friedman-Robertson-Walker part, plus a perturbation part, where the perturbation is zero when those h and zeta variables are zero, but they are the perturbation to g, and then the field you also write as a homogeneous part that only depends on time plus a perturbation. Then we impose our gauge conditions, which in particular cut this guy out, and put this in the form written up there. We plug all of this in and expand to second order in delta g, or in other words, expand to second order, Taylor expand this expression to second order in the variables zeta and phi. And what we get is that at the end of the day is the following expression for the action expanded to second order. It's a sum of two pieces, a piece that only contains zeta, and a piece that only contains the perturbation h. And the zeta piece ends up looking very simple. It's just so if you neglected this factor, this would just be the action for a free scalar field in Minkowski space. Eta mu nu is the Minkowski metric, with no potential. And so what we've done is we've inserted into that action a function z squared of eta that only depends on time. The particular function z is just defined to be the scale factor squared times the conformal time derivative of the background scalar field divided by the conformal time derivative of A. Anyway, it's not crucial at the moment what the particular thing is. It's just some function of eta that can be calculated once you know how the scale factor depends on eta and how the background scalar field depends on eta. So now the calculation that you do in the homework, or that you will be taken through step by step in the homework, is that just in exactly the same way that you canonically quantize a free scalar field in an ordinary quantum field theory course, you follow exactly the same steps to quantize this action, which is almost, apart from this factor, is almost exactly the same as quantizing a free scalar field. But this factor makes all the difference. The fact that this factor is in there is ultimately the thing that is going to, instead of just letting the ground state sit there and the mode functions happily oscillate, is going to pump them and make them behave in a way that is more interesting. And so at the end of the day, so you basically follow Dirac's prescription for how you quantize something. You take the action, which depends on some variables q and q dot. Let's forget about t. You know, and you. I give you the classical Lagrangian, and then you're instructed by Dirac to calculate the momentum conjugate to q by p is equal to partial l partial q dot. That's the definition of the momentum. Then you calculate the Hamiltonian. Hamiltonian is defined to be p q dot minus l. And then, you know, this thing, the idea is this is a Legendre transform. So this you should now think of as a function just of p and q. And then, finally, that's all classical mechanics so far. The step that where we quantize is we just declare that p and q are now operators that obey the so-called canonical commutation relations, which is that q commutes with itself, or any q commutes with any other q. Any p commutes with any other p, but any q commutes with any other p except for its own conjugate p. So when I and j are the same, in other words, when when Q is a variable and P is its canonical conjugate, then it doesn't commute. Its commutator is equal to IH bar. So we just apply that technology to this Lagrangian, okay? But then now that these guys are operators, suddenly the Hamiltonian is an operator, and whatever state of the system, you know, we have it at time t equals zero. At an infinitesimally later time, we get the state at infinitesimally later time by propagating it forward by the time evolution operator e to the minus ih dt. So we do that to this guy, and at the end of the day, we have a quantum operator with a quantum evolution law. So what used to formerly be the classical perturbation variable zeta that appeared up there is now a quantum operator. And we can define, so we can ask what happens if we take the square of that operator. So this is some operator that depends on space and time. It's a quantum field. Take the square of it. Take its vacuum expectation value. Its vacuum expectation value will turn out to look like something. What you will show in the homework is that its vacuum expectation value is the integral of dk over k times k cubed over 2 pi squared. Okay, it's equal to dk over k times something, where that something is defined to be the primordial scalar power spectrum, and it is the thing that you measure in the CMB. And so the problem on the homework will be to derive the standard inflationary expression for this thing. But the point is, it's actually quite an easy calculation to do, and you'll be. I mean, that I'm sure it sounds maybe not easy given how I just described it. But anyway, the homework will lead you through that calculation step by step. But that's the basic idea, that the primordial scalar power spectrum, this thing that is measured and whose value is reported in the abstract of the papers that get put out by WMAP, is nothing but, from the inflationary standpoint, is nothing but the derivative dk over k is log k. So it's nothing but the derivative of this expression. The expectation value of this quantum field, the derivative with respect to log k. In other words, it just picks out this thing. What can we say about this with 5 minutes left? To make a long story short, this I am not going to have the time to bring this to a sensible conclusion, which will have to be done in hopefully clear notes accompanying the problem set. So the gist to get across is, one, if you want to see this calculation done in more leisurely detail, please take the Cosmological Explorations course, because it turns out I ran out of time, and I'm not going to really be able to properly explain it in class. Two, nevertheless, the idea that I hope you will take away, even if you don't do the Cosmological Explorations course, is that somehow people say that inflation stretches and amplifies vacuum fluctuations in the early universe and turns them into primordial fluctuations. You should get from this that there is some very concrete and elementary calculation behind those words, where the idea is that you just have a universe that just has gravity plus a scalar field. You let those be perturbed a little bit. You ask, what is the classical action governing those perturbations? You find, either through a big mess or with the help of Maldacena, a simple answer at the end. It's almost exactly the action for one of the simplest quantum fields that you meet right at the beginning of your quantum field theory education. You follow the same mechanism to quantize this action that you did with in the first semester of field theory that you took. And at the end of the day, you just take the vacuum expectation value of the of that field operator squared. That's telling you, you know, what is the expected amount by which the field fluctuates? What is the expected amount by which the metric, the determinant of the metric in this gauge, or which is related to the curvature, fluctuates at a given point in space? And then you can ask, well, how much of those fluctuations are coming from different wavelengths? Some of the fluctuation of the field is coming from very long wavelength modes, which have a very small wave number k. Some of the fluctuation is coming from very short wavelength modes, which have a very large wave number k. So breaking up this root mean squared value into its contribution from each different band in k gives you something that you can go out and measure more easily, because you can now, for example, by pointing your telescope at two different points on the sky, you look out at a triangle. You look at the temperature here and the temperature here, which are coming from two blobs that were separated by some physical distance. And then if I point my telescope at two different points that are separated by a smaller angle, I'm looking at two blobs that are separated by a smaller distance, that is to say, a bigger wave number. And I find that the temperature that I that I observe that the typical fluctuation between the temperature here and the temperature here, and if I hold that angle fixed and I keep measuring it at different pairs of points all over the sky, in other words, if I measure the fluctuation between one point and another on a fixed at a fixed length scale at a fixed wavelength, the typical fluctuation will correspond to the predicted value for some value of k corresponding to that wavelength. And on the other hand, if I do the same exercise but with the two points on the sky separated by a larger angle, so the two points that are emitting to me separated by a larger distance, that corresponds to measuring the RMS fluctuation on a different length scale. And so you can compare the predicted expression as a function of k to the observed one. And the point is that almost automatically, the expression predicted by inflation says that this power spectrum should be scale invariant, should have, in some sense, no dependence on k. It should be almost independent of what angle you look on. And in fact, that is also what observations show. That is also what you need to put in to fit observations of the cosmic microwave background. So, I don't know what to say. It is it's a kind of complicated business, and then if you want to also take those primordial perturbations and evolve them to today, which people also do theoretically, and then compare to observations, that's an even more complicated business. If anyone of you ever get to the point where you think of a nice, easy way to explain this complicated business, I would love to hear about it, but that's about the best that I can do in the allotted time. So anyway, thanks very much. It was a lot of fun. You laughed at least a third of my jokes. I really appreciate that. It's probably twice as many as the last year's class laughed at. So anyway, yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much.